complaining about the cold for the last couple of days. So, and I've been here since 1973. I don't ever remember it being as cold as it was today. However, where I grew up, how we measured it cold, if you spit and your spit shatters when it hits the ground, then it's cold. You say, well, how cold does it have to be before your spit shatters when it hits the ground? 50 below. So if it's 50 below or colder, that will happen. And, where I have some relatives in northern Canada where literally 100-proof whiskey freezes if you leave it outside. So one place where you can get whiskey that's a little more proof than 100. Anyway, so much with the jokes here. Major announcement came up from NASA this week that I'd like to briefly address. And if you want to see something in a little more detail, there's a press release on our reasons.org website. But NASA has actually claimed that those Viking explorers that went to Mars in the mid-1970s, that they killed Martian life. And, yeah, you heard that? Yeah. Yeah, maybe there'll be a murder trial here. We'll see. Well, the basis of the claim is that the Viking explorers searched for life by pouring water on the Martian ground and seeing if there would be any biological activity that would take advantage of that water. And they didn't find anything. But now there's some NASA scientists claiming that life on Mars is not like life here on Earth, where you've got cells, and inside the cells, you have a water, a salt water kind of solute that maintains the biochemistry. And their point is that on Mars, if you had a salt water solute inside the cell, it would freeze and it would die. And so their claim is that inside Martian life or Martian cells is the equivalent of antifreeze. And what antifreeze would work? They say a combination of water and hydrogen peroxide. And so then the point is if you pour water on life that's got hydrogen peroxide in it, you'll kill it. And so their claim is that these Viking craft actually killed the Martian life that they were looking for. Now, in support of this, they claim that we have hydrogen peroxide-based life here on Mars. And the one example they point out, and I only know of one, I don't know of any other, it's the Bombardier beetle. It's this little tropical beetle, and the way it wards off its enemies is it shoots a hydrogen peroxide spray at its enemies. It's very effective. And their whole point is, well, since you already have hydrogen peroxide life here on Earth, why not on Mars? Well, a couple of responses we've made to this in our press release on our website is that hydrogen peroxide-based life would be the most extreme of the extremophiles that we've ever discussed. And there was a research paper published more than 2 years ago now in the journal Astrobiology, and it was published by some atheist Origin of Life researchers making the impassioned plea to the Origin of Life community that extremophiles are irrelevant to the Origin of Life. In other words, we see here on planet Earth all manners of extreme life. And what I mean by extremophiles would not be... I'm not going to make the joke. That's all right. Can't think of his name right now. But life forms that can exist, say, in Yellowstone Park, where you've got these pools where the water would burn you. But you actually see bacteria in that water that's 200 degrees Fahrenheit. And you also see bacteria in Antarctica where it's below freezing. By the way, there is life on planet Earth that's got the equivalent of antifreeze in it. It's just that it's not hydrogen peroxide. And the antifreeze is only effective down to a few degrees above freezing, not to the conditions we see on Mars. But nevertheless, we see life on planet Earth that exists under very cold conditions, under very hot conditions, under high pressure conditions. We see life under very acidic conditions and very basic conditions. However, life cannot originate under those conditions. The reason why we see these extremophiles all over planet Earth is that they have the benefit of depending upon the nutrients that are provided for them by what we call mesophiles. Mesophiles is a term for life that exists under benign conditions. So all of us in here are mesophiles. we exist under benign conditions, and the conditions get extreme, we don't do very well. But there are life forms that can't survive under benign conditions, but they can survive under extreme conditions. But they depend on the mesophiles for the nutrient stream they need to live under those extreme conditions. And if you look at those extreme conditions, you can't find any possible biochemical pathway in which you can put the molecules together. That's the basis for the statement that extremophiles are irrelevant to the origin of life. Now, I wish NASA would get that message, because what they're doing is they're looking all over the solar system to find the equivalent of extremophiles on these other bodies in our solar system. But these are bodies where we would not find mesophiles. And if you can't find mesophiles, you're not going to find extremophiles, because extremophiles are dependent upon the mesophiles for life. But this is the most extreme extremophile I know of anyone has ever appealed to, because of all these extreme conditions, the worst of all for trying to put together any biochemical pathway would be an environment with hydrogen peroxide. You know, any of you who've played with hydrogen peroxide know that it's very corrosive. Oxygen, by the way, is corrosive, but hydrogen peroxide is especially corrosive, and it will immediately break down any biochem. And the appeal to the Bombardier Beetle is a bad appeal, because the Bombardier Beetle does not really have, or does not really exploit hydrogen peroxide for any of its life functions. It simply stores hydrogen peroxide liquid in a sac inside its body. And that sac is very strong, and it protects the rest of the Bombardier Beetle from the poison that's inside that sac. So this really is not a good analogy. You can't use a Bombardier Beetle as an analogy for, say, see, here you can have hydrogen peroxide-based life. That hydrogen peroxide in the Bombardier Beetle never resides inside a cell. It's in this little storage sac. And incidentally, the hydrogen peroxide in that storage sac is so toxic that the beetle only makes that stuff just before it thinks it's going to need it. And if the danger doesn't arise where it is going to need it, it gets rid of it anyway, because it doesn't dare store that hydrogen peroxide fluid in that sac for very long. If it does, it'll break down the sac, and the hydrogen peroxide will invade the tissues of the Bombardier Beetle and kill it. That's the interesting thing about the Bombardier Beetle. It's got this deadly poison spray inside the sac, but if there's no enemies around, it gets rid of it anyway, because it doesn't want to keep it inside of its body. And then it waits until it thinks the risk is going to come and make some more. And but it gets rid of it quite readily. But the bottom line is you're not going to find antifreeze life on Mars. You're not going to have mesophiles. You're not going to have the antifreeze life either. Yes. Well, that anomalous result was, I mean, the Viking wasn't as sophisticated as craft we have today, nowhere near it. And one of the experiments searching for life produced an ambiguous result. They couldn't tell whether it was evidence for life or evidence for non-life. And it's been written off as non-evidence, because it said, you know, the ambiguity was such that, you know, it couldn't have determined if there was life in the Sahara Desert. So the fact that it didn't make a conclusive conclusion one way or the other on Mars is really no big deal. And actually, I think most people in NASA looked at the Viking experiments as kind of a first try. You know, let's do something we know we can do, get it there, and see what happens. And if there was abundant life on Mars, it would have found it. So what it really did is show that life wasn't abundant on or diverse on Mars. And that's why there's been a move to go back to Mars and see what they can find. But up to this time, there's been no positive evidence for life on Mars. But what they've been getting excited about is they have found positive evidence for what I would call ephemeral water, water that exists in tiny amounts for a short period of time. But that raises another issue. Can life actually benefit from water that remains for a short period of time? And in small quantities. And again, I think one of the problems with NASA is they're looking at water as the only requirement for life, when in fact there are many other requirements. Nevertheless, we end our press release with the claim that NASA will find life on Mars or the remains of life on Mars if they look hard enough. And that's simply because the surface of Mars is littered with Earth bacteria. And you say, how do you know that? Well, there are literally thousands, if not millions of tons of Earth material on the surface of Mars. And every single ton of Earth material has an excess of 100 quadrillion bacteria. So just take one ton of Earth material, and inside we know there's at least 100 quadrillion bacteria. And so if you're dumping tens of thousands of tons of Earth material on the surface of Mars through meteoritic impacts, then you've got the surface of Mars littered with the remains of Earth bacteria. Now, Mars is a big place. If you spread all that Earth material evenly over the surface of Mars, yeah, you've got a lot of bacteria there, but it's still rather thinly distributed. And we have argued that a much better place to look would be the Moon. The Moon is closer to the Earth and has a much richer supply of Earth material, literally 20,000 pounds for every 100 square kilometers, where compared to only 200 pounds on the surface of Mars. And so we want to find the remains of Earth life. The easiest place to find it would be on the surface of the Moon. But we can guarantee it's the remains. It won't be viable life. On neither Mars or the Moon do we have conditions that would allow Earth transported life to live for anything more than about 2 seconds. So what we're going to, NASA will find, is the broken down remains. Particularly so since a vast quantity of that life, because the meteoritic impacts were far more intense 3 billion years ago than they are today. And in 3 billion years, the radiation that impinges upon the Moon and Mars will very significantly break down the biochemistry of those bacteria. So it will be a real challenge for NASA to detect the remains of Earth life. On the other hand, the Moon is an excellent place to go to find the fossils of Earth's first life. The conditions on the Moon are geologically very stable, and the Earth material gets buried, the fossils should be intact. You're not going to get the DNA, but you will get at least the appearance of the cellular structures. Question over here? We do, but in small quantities. Okay, any of you have been to Arizona? I think it's by Highway 10. There's this little town called Winslow, just past Phoenix. And if you take the 2 mile drive off of Highway 10, you will be in front of a huge crater. The crater is almost a mile across and about 350 feet deep. And that crater was caused by a meteor that hit that part of the Arizona desert about 10,000 years ago. And it wasn't that big of a meteor. It was only 100 feet across. But it blew out a hole that big and hit the Earth with such force, namely at about 100 miles per second, that many tons of Earth material were ejected away from the gravity of the planet. And about 2% of that ejected material will wind up on Mars. Now, it's not there yet. Typically, it takes about 10 million years for the stuff that's ejected to finally land on a solar system body. In the case of the Moon, it's shorter time. So if you're talking a planet, the typical travel time is about 10 million years, which means by the time it gets to Mars, the life is certainly dead and certainly biochemically very broken down. So by that means, material is being transported to Mars on a continual basis. For 3 and 4 billion years ago, the impact rate was thousands of times greater than it is right now. And therefore, most of the Earth material on the solar system bodies would have been moved there billions of years ago rather than just, say, thousands of years ago. Yes. Well, the typical size would be dust. However, if you get a meteor, say, a mile in diameter hitting the Earth, it will also send big boulders to the distant planets in our solar system. So it all depends on... there's Earth material floating all over the solar system. By the way, it works the other way around, too. I mean, we get Moon dust being deposited on the Earth, Martian dust, and we now have in museums and laboratories 22 boulders that have been transported from Mars to Earth. But as we look at those boulders, we see zero evidence for life. I mean, no amino acid signatures that aren't the result of contamination. That's what got NASA excited years ago. I mean, you may recall our former president, Bill Clinton, did a dance around one of these Martian meteorites when they announced that they had found the remains of life in the meteorite. Now, what they found in that meteorite, the meteorite landed in Antarctica, and what they found in that meteorite were three amino acids. But the three amino acids they found were identical to the amino acids you find in the Antarctic meltwater in the vicinity of where this rock had landed. And it's in the same ratios of the amino acids as in the meltwater. And so the answer was that they were looking at Earth contamination rather than actual remains of Martian life. And by the way, that's true of all 22 of the Martian meteors. When we do see DNA, the DNA is always the DNA signature of the vicinity in which it fell. In fact, a group of Canadians have found a meteorite that landed on a frozen lake in the middle of winter, and they recovered that meteorite within a few days after it landed. And even then, it was contaminated already with the amino acids of Earth life, which is why NASA's convinced if we're ever going to prove that there's life remains in one of these meteorites, we have to catch it before it lands. But that's quite a challenge. Yeah. Oh, that's relatively easy to determine, because in every one of these rocks, you'll find air pockets in the interior. And so you analyze the atmospheric components of that little air pocket. And if it's identical to the Martian atmosphere, then that tells you it came from Mars. And I've actually found one rock that's come from Mercury. Because we can find inside that rock the signature of Mercury's atmosphere. And we can do the same thing with that. That's how we tell whether it's from the moon. We do have some from, Mercury, the moon, and Mars are the only ones where we can positively identify. That's because we know the atmospheric constituents of those quite well. Some have never been exposed. Some have actually been distributed in classrooms like this. So, but yeah, they've kept some hermetically sealed. And there's a lot of enthusiasm in NASA about going back to the moon and getting a lot more. We could learn a lot more about the moon and the history of the solar system if we can recover a few more of those rocks. So, okay, any more comments? All right, let's get into our lesson. I got another great scientific discovery to talk to you about, but I'll save that for next week. It's a real neat one. It has to do with teeth, actually. The teeth of mice and the teeth of human beings being remarkably similar. Yeah, we'll save that for next time. Okay. What I want to do is give you some demonstrations today of how the biblical claim that the gospel has been preached to every creature actually bears up. And we're going to do that by looking at the book of Job and seeing how Job was able to pick out every point, every essential doctrinal point of the gospel of our salvation by looking at the second book that God has given us. Belgic Confession, one of the great Reformation confessions, makes the point that God has given us two books, the Bible and the book of nature. And what we've been doing is going through these verses that talk about general revelation, and we know how strongly the Bible claims that based on general revelation, every human being has heard the gospel. And we've been looking at some of the verses that do this. I'm just going to take you real quickly through this. Job makes the point that the natural revelation, the birds, the creatures, and the animals, actually have much to teach us about God's ways. And there is this message of humility that comes through Psalm 8. The heavens declare the glory of God. Their words are written upon the heavens for all of us to read. This is where the Belgic confessors got the idea of the two books. Psalm 19 actually tells us that the record of nature is akin to a book. The word of the Lord is right and true. He is faithful in all he does, which means that the record of nature gives us just as faithful a revelation as the words of the Bible do. By the way, I had a radio interview Saturday night, wonderful hour, midnight till 2 in the morning, But I understand now that that's the second most busy radio time slot. There's afternoon drive time, and the next big spot where you get the greatest listening audience is in the wee hours of the morning. Must be a lot of insomniacs, I guess, particularly here in the L.A. Basin. It was KKLA, and they brought me on because this particular show gets a lot, and it was probably predominantly younger creationists that listen to this Christian show. And they've been complaining a lot about all these reasons to believe people that they have on the show and how we're older and not younger. And so the host, John Snyder, said, he's been advertising this for months, saying, look, we're bringing Dr. Ross on the show. All you younger creationists out there, this is your chance to ask him questions, put him on the spot, and see if you can disprove him. And but when we did the show Saturday night, we didn't have any younger creationists call in. And John Snyder couldn't. So they've been complaining for months and sending me emails, and now I give them a chance, and they don't bother. So you're saying, well, you know, why don't they bother? And I said, well, what did your professor tell you? He was a student at Biola. He said, oh, yeah, I remember. My professor said, when it comes to the age of the earth, there is no debate. The debate is only within the church over understanding of the Bible. There really is no scientific debate on the age of the earth. And but he was rather intrigued that, you know, here all these people complain, and when they had the chance, they didn't respond. But one of the things we talked about there is this book of nature and how it is reliable and trustworthy. But one question that came, two lawyers interviewed me, and they tried to ask all the questions they've been getting in the emails from the younger friends. And one of them is a charge, well, that Hugh Ross and Reasons to Believe believes that the record of nature is superior to the words of the Bible. We've never said that. But the way I responded to that, I said, that's really akin to a debate amongst Christians over, you know, what's your favorite book of the Bible? And, you know, people arguing that the book of Romans is a more faithful revelation than, say, the book of Esther or the book of Hebrews or, you know, the book of Revelation. The truth is, all 66 books of the Bible are the perfect word of God. But do they all say the same thing? No, they don't. They address different subjects. So I would fully agree that the book of Romans is superior to the book of Esther when it's addressing the subject of propitiation. But that the book of Esther is superior to the book of Romans when it's addressing the issue of Israelite history. I mean, they do address different themes. And that's also true of the record of nature. So the record of nature is a perfect revelation of God, but it does address different subject material than this book does. Although all books of the Bible overlap. In the book of Esther, you will find content on the doctrine of propitiation. It's just not as extensive or as specific or as detailed as what you get in the book of Romans. There is overlap amongst God's revelations, which is why I'm very much in dispute with Stephen Jay Gould, where he tries to claim that theology and science never overlap. There's huge overlap between science and theology, which is one reason why God has given us these different books, so that we can see the overlap and see how they collaborate. Okay, that's enough for that. Those that dwell in the ends of the earth stand in awe of your signs. Let's get some of these verses that actually talk about the gospel. The heavens proclaim his righteousness, and all the people see his glory. The heavens not only proclaim the glory of God, but the righteousness of God. And then there's this verse in Psalm 98. The Lord has made his salvation known and revealed his righteousness to the nations. All the ends of the earth have seen the salvation of our God. Rather explicit and repeated statements to the effect that everybody, no matter what nation they're in, no matter what theological state they're in, have seen the salvation message that the Lord has made available to every one of us. So the heavens declare the righteousness of God, and this verse makes it clear that this extends even to our understanding of salvation. How many are your works, O Lord? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your possessions. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Now let's get to some more verses. This talks about one of the ways God does this. He makes sure we get exposed to death, that we get to go to a lot of funerals. And by going to a lot of funerals, we get to focus on what God really is revealing to us through the record of nature. Because even though God has made his salvation clear through the record of nature, people have this tendency of not paying attention. Well, funerals is one great way to get people to focus on that. And personally, I think that's one of the easiest ways to lead people to Christ, to invite them to a funeral. And hopefully there'll be a message there that brings the point home. All right. The earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. His glory covers the heavens. He has not left himself without testimony. He shows kindness. The love of God is available to us through nature. And the Romans tells us that we're all without excuse. Now, when it says we're all without excuse, I think that means a whole lot more than we're simply without excuse about the idea that God exists. I believe this applies to those who face the Lord after they've gone through this life, and they say, oh, I had no idea that judgment was coming. And the Lord says, you're without excuse. You knew judgment was coming. I don't have the verse here, but John chapter 16 makes the point that God's Spirit communicates the message of coming judgment to every human being. That's something that God has placed within us, the knowledge that we will be judged. Let me get through this. This is a little idea of how people ignore what God is revealing us through the record of nature. And Romans 2. Requirements of the law are written on their hearts. The record of nature is more extensive than just the scientific stuff. God has actually written his law on the heart of every human being. We call it the conscience. And that conscience bears witness to it. And we're going to study in the book of Job exactly how that conscience works. But part of the conscience is the idea that judgment is coming, that there is a test after this life is all over. And then Romans 10. Did they not hear? Of course they did. Their voice has gone up into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. And this is the same passage where Paul is saying, how can they hear unless someone goes and talks to them? But it says, did they not hear? Of course they did. So Paul is making the point of how important it is that missionaries and evangelists go out and communicate the message of salvation to all the peoples of the world. But he's reminding them that when they do go out, they have already heard. It's just that most people need to hear the gospel about 8 different times in 8 different ways before it gets through their prideful heart and it really begins to stick. So we do need to go out. But anyone who's been in the mission field, I think, can recognize that when you do go out, it's clear that people have a basic understanding of what they already know. God has prepared them in advance. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I was just talking to Charlie Myers just before this class got started. And next week, he's taking retirement from the railroad. And he says one of the things he wants to do as a retired railroad worker is revive the door-to-door evangelism ministry we have operating here in the church. And he'd like to pull together a team and make that happen. He says, Hugh, did you keep all your papers from those days? He says, yep, I got them all. So he's going to come by my office and get all those papers and then try to recruit a team and make that happen again. But the secret of going door-to-door and talking to people is learning how to ask the right questions. And you can't ask the same questions in every neighborhood. And one of the things we did back in the old days is we'd go out into different neighborhoods and try to take a survey of the spiritual state of people, and then we use that to frame a survey that would help get them into the key points. Because every neighborhood is different. And one of the things that surprised me when I was a full-time minister of evangelism here is you can't even count on the neighborhood staying stable. I remember going into Hastings Ranch and discovering a very different population there 5 years after we first started working in that neighborhood. It had changed. And if we hadn't recognized the change, we would have been not as successful as we were. And by the way, different neighborhoods have different success ratios. The most successful neighborhood we ever found was a neighborhood filled with single mothers who were working and trying to give their kids a good education. The receptivity rate was above 70%. What I mean by that is 7 out of 10 or more would listen to a full presentation of the gospel and give serious consideration about giving their life to Christ. And you say, well, where did you find the worst result? The worst result was in a neighborhood in Arcadia, and it's different today, but back then, where a lot of people had moved in who were relatively young and had just come into a lot of money. In other words, they were raised middle class and suddenly they were wealthy. And we found that the receptivity rate there was only 4%. And, you know, but however, when we went into San Marino, and which was even a wealthier area, we found the receptivity rate there was about 50%. But the difference was that in San Marino, you had multi-generational wealth. People who were living there typically had been wealthy for several generations. Wealthy long enough to realize money's not the answer to life. Whereas these people who were young in Arcadia, who had just come into a lot of wealth, they were still deceived into thinking, if you're rich, that takes care of everything. So, you know, in that sense we discovered, and by the way, another area that was proved to be very unproductive, in fact, it was at the same level as this one neighborhood in Arcadia. It was a very poor neighborhood, but very unreceptive. And what we discovered is that we were tapping into a population group where everyone there were welfare cheaters. And it was hard to get them to open the door because they thought we were government officials that were checking up on their cheating. But the difference between that neighborhood and this poor neighborhood with single working moms in it is the homes of the welfare cheaters were a terrible mess. There's garbage piled everywhere. The lawn wasn't, you know, nothing was being kept up. And there we found that it was not very receptive at all. So you can't make the mistake of saying all we're going to do is look at the income and it'll tell us where to go. It's true that the poor tend to be more receptive, but you will find people who do have wealth who are very receptive. It all depends on their mind state. And because this is Southern California, the population turns over very quickly. I don't know what it's like today because I'm not active on the Board of Elders here, but when I was, our survey showed that the church population turned over every 4 years. And we virtually got a brand new congregation every 4 years because people move in and out of this area so quickly. In fact, one survey we did showed that renters turn over in 7 months on the average. Homeowners turn over in 4.5 years. So even people who own their own home tend to stay in that home for only 4.5 years. Now, I imagine in Iowa it's a little different. People a little more stable. But out here there's a very high turnover, which is why I commend this effort, because churches here in Southern California, if you're not actively doing evangelism, your church will die. Just because of turnover. The turnover will kill you. So you got to keep people flowing through. And if you want a growing church, let's say a church of this size, for a church of this size to grow, you need 50 visitors a week just to stay even or to grow a little bit. So I don't think we're there yet. We need to get back to that kind of situation. But the way you do it is through an aggressive evangelism ministry. Yeah. 16:8. That's correct. Right. That's the verse. Thank you. And then the last verse we looked at was Colossians 1:23. This is the gospel that you heard, and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, every man, woman, and child. Okay, what I want to do is take you through the book of Job, and what we're going to see is that this is not unique to Job. Now, Job is one of the three most righteous men that we see recorded in the Old Testament. Ezekiel refers to him in that context. And indeed, he is a very righteous and very humble man, and because of his righteousness and humility, he was able to see things in the record of nature that would have been difficult for someone under different conditions. However, there was another man who also figured it all out, and that was Elihu. So the book of Job is really a debate amongst five people. Job debates his three friends, and you got one young man that just listens to the debate. But at the end of the book of Job, Elihu jumps into the debate. And what Elihu does is restate this gospel that Job had preached, but does it in different ways and in different forms. Because really the context of the book of Job is Job going through this suffering through a test that God performs. There is a challenge and a test that God faces. We get introduced to Satan in the book of Job and this test that takes place. And the first part of the debate is Job declaring this gospel of salvation based on the record of nature. The second part of the debate are Job's three friends that wear him down and begin to crumble his argument. And just at the point where it looks like Job's been beaten down, and by the way, it's probably never a good idea to do a three-against-one debate, particularly if you're debating. These guys were clever debaters. I mean, if you read what they had to say, they were very good debaters. And here was Job under extreme physical suffering, trying to put up a defense against three skilled debaters. Probably not a good idea. But Elihu comes in and rescues Job's argument at the end. So that's the context. And what I'm going to do is close this out, because I actually have another PowerPoint here that does this a little more thoroughly than what I got here. So we will exit this one. And here we go. And pick up. Okay, here we go. Now, the first thing Job does in this debate is establish that God exists. And he doesn't get an argument from his three friends on that. They basically agree with him. Yes, you're right, God exists. But this is the passage that Job uses. Actually, there are several. It goes on for a couple of chapters. All I did was pull out a verse here. He says, in his hand, God's hand, is the life of every creature and the breath of all mankind. Now, I find this an interesting passage because this is where the Darwinists of today, I think, are not paying attention. All they're looking at are the bodies of all these creatures and trying to figure out how you can get those bodies without invoking a God. But a body is kind of like a car. A car doesn't do anything until a driver gets behind the wheel and turns the ignition. And, one of the scientists on our board of directors, Alex Metherall, said, okay, when I'm debating Darwinists, I always ask him, where's the ignition switch? Okay, maybe you can explain how all this biochemistry comes about. I don't think you can, but he says, even if you could, how would you explain what it is inside the cell that tells it to go from death to life? And what is it that causes it to go from life to death? Because that's really what it's like for a human being to die. The ignition gets turned on. And reaches that point where God says, hey, it's time. And God's the one that turns the key off. We don't turn the key on. He does. He picks that time for us to die, and he shuts down. And this automobile in which we live basically stops functioning. And that's really how we should be thinking about our human bodies. They're like automobiles. Our spirit resides inside the body, and the spirit controls the body. But the body wouldn't live without the spirit. And this is the point that Job makes here. In the life of every creature, there is the breath of God within us that causes us to live. And he said, how do you explain the fact that we're all living unless there is a God that tells the little biochemical machinery in there to start moving? Or to use another analogy, instead of a car, think of a factory. The factory doesn't produce any goods until the factory superintendent says, let's turn on all the machines. And let's make sure the machines are coordinated and actually producing some product. And at the end of the day, or the end of the shift, they turn the machines off. And so Job makes this point, that God is the one and is really the only answer for what tells all this machinery to start operating and to start living. Then the second point that Job makes is that not only is there a God, this God is extremely powerful and very smart. There's the wisdom and the power. It says his wisdom is profound, his power is vast. And there's a reason why I use the Hubble Ultra Deep Field here as a background. Not just because the objects are small and I can put writing on it, but makes this whole point here that the power of God is vast. I mean, now that we have the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, we can actually calculate or count up the number of stars in the observable universe. And it comes to 50 billion trillion stars. 5.0 times 10 to the 23 stars is what exists in the observable universe. And God created all that. And elsewhere in the Bible it tells us God's got a name for every star. That's a lot of stars that he has named. And he knows all their names. He knows all of our names, 6 billion of us. He knows every name. He knows the name of every star. His power is vast. His wisdom is profound. And this is the point we've been looking at going through these scriptures, making the point that no matter how much scientific research we pour into studying the record of nature, we can't figure out the profundity of God's wisdom. It's beyond us. Yet every day we're discovering more and more, but there's no limit. One of the promises I like from the Bible, which is very encouraging to me, is that no matter how much scientific research we put in, we'll never figure out everything there is to know about any subject of science, which means I have no risk of being unemployed. The job will never be finished. That's because of the incredible profundity of God's wisdom. Once again, this is a point that is not disputed by Job's three friends. They accept it. They say, yeah, we agree with you. There is a God, and this God is extremely powerful and extremely wise. But Job goes on to make more points. He says he performs wonders that cannot be fathomed, miracles that cannot be numbered. And if you look at the context here, he's making a reference to his own life, where he says, God has performed miracles on my behalf, so many miracles, I can't number them all. Now, I think that would be a good exercise for every one of us to take home, is to think back through your life and document all the time that God has performed miracles on your behalf. And we're kind of like the children of Israel that were in the wilderness. Now, here's Moses taking the children out of Egypt and into the wilderness, and God cares for them for 40 years with manna. He performs great miracles. He separates the waters, and they get to cross the Red Sea on dry land. And then this powerful Egyptian army gets wiped out with the waves coming back at just the right time. And what happens towards the end of the wilderness experience? Moses discovers that the people have forgotten. They have forgotten all these amazing miracles. But that doesn't surprise me, because I forget all the miracles that God has done in my behalf. I think we all tend to do that. But that's one of the points that Job makes. He says, God is so powerful and so wise. And the point he's getting at here, because his next point is going to be about how loving the Creator is. And but one of the suggestions he's making here is that God is so intimate with us, he actually personally performs miracles on behalf of every one of us. Every human being, if they look at their life, can see evidence for God's miraculous intervention. Now, I'm going to give you a chance in the class here to relate a few of these, okay? And I'm not going to give you a general one. I'm going to give you a more specific one. It's based on, because this is the very next point that Job makes here. He says, God has performed miracles beyond number. Says, you, referring to God, gave me life and showed me kindness. And in your providence, you watched over my spirit. Now, I think this is one of the easiest ways we can look back over our life and document the miracles that God has performed on our behalf. God watches over every one of us to preserve our life and to keep us from danger. And so what I'm going to do is just give you a couple of examples from my own life, because I was just thinking about this morning. Okay, I'm going to ask the class for this. And usually when I do this in the class, I get 5 minutes of silence before things actually start coming up. So what I'm going to do is just give you a couple of examples from my own personal life. And I was able to make a list of over a dozen times when God had preserved my life, when my life was actually in danger, and he pulled me out of danger and kept me alive. And I think every one of us who's more than, say, 10 years old can look back over your life and recognize, you know, if it wasn't a God, I should be dead. There's no way I should be alive, given all the circumstances that are coming in my life. God has rescued me repeatedly. And Job uses this as an argument for the fact God is profoundly loving towards each one of us as individuals. Okay, a couple of stories. I got my PhD. And I had reserved 2 months in advance for a room in the Athenaeum. And I had it reserved for a couple of weeks. And the whole idea was I would stay in that room, then I'd be able to find a place to live while I got settled there and I got going on my research. Well, I showed up about 9 p.m. on January 3rd in 1973, and the lady said, we don't have a room for you. And I said, well, how come? He said, well, we had a lot of big-wig professors come in, and we gave away your room. And that's very convenient. And I said, but don't worry, we'll find you another room. There's lots of hotels in Pasadena. Well, it was January 3rd, and it turned out there weren't any hotel rooms in the area. Rose Parade and everything, right. So they put me up on the outside balcony of the Athenaeum. So I slept outside. On the balcony, and was there for some, so I was rather eager to find an apartment, and I did find one, but you know, I was naive about this area, and so I wound up settling in to call it the ghetto attack, evidently, and we've got some policemen here in the class, I understand that there's one neighborhood in Pasadena where over 90% of the crimes of Pasadena occur. Well, that was where I was able to find an apartment, right there. And there was nothing else available because it was rather tight housing shortage at the time, so I settled into this place. And I was from Canada, and I was naive. Everybody in that apartment complex was black, except for me. But I thought nothing of it. That happens all the time in Toronto, that, it was no big deal. And, I didn't realize that I was moving into a kind of a gang environment. And the blacks there were very nervous. I saw drugs everywhere. But I said, no big deal. When I was in Toronto, drugs were everywhere there, too. They didn't prosecute in Canada for drug possession, so drugs were everywhere. So I didn't think anything of it. However, the people in the apartment were very alarmed at me. I said, here's this young white guy in this apartment with all these drugs, and he's not flinching an eyebrow. He's got to be a narc. So I was only there for a couple of days, and about six blacks pulled me into their apartment. And they were all high on, I forget the drug, it was cocaine. They're all high on cocaine, and they're all screaming and yelling at me that I had to be a narcotics agent, and they were all debating on how they were going to kill me. And I said, oh, this isn't good. So I was trying to tell them, look, you've made a mistake. I'm from Canada. And they said, likely story. You don't have any accent. So I wasn't getting, I said, look, I'm from Caltech, and I'm an astronomer. And I tried to tell them about some stuff in astronomy, but evidently they didn't have enough education to realize that what I was saying actually had any justification. This went on for a couple of hours, and they were grabbing me and about to haul me out, and I said, this is not good. And then suddenly this huge black guy showed up. He was over 6'8", enormous guy. And he was a bouncer in the place. And he says, what's going on here? And so they said, look, this guy's a narcotics agent. We've got to get rid of him because he's seen all this stuff. And but he said, well, I want to hear his story. So I explained my story to him. And he told the other six guys, says, look, there's at least a 10% chance of what he's saying is true. We need to check it out. Now, we can call Caltech, and they'll tell us whether or not. And he said, well, he may be on the Caltech faculty. He could still be a narcotics agent. However, he did encourage the six to let me go, and I moved out that night. Within 30 minutes, I was passed and out of there. So, yeah. Well, there's more to the story. I made the mistake of waving at a police helicopter. That's when they decided to grab me. I didn't know it was a police helicopter. They thought I was signaling. Well, now I found a safe place to live in Pasadena, but I wound up, there's a place in the Canadian Rockies where I always had wanted to hike. I never hiked there. And I was trying to tell people at Caltech what a great place this was, and we got to go there. And nobody wanted to go, but I wanted to go. I figured, well, if no one's going to go, I'm going to go on my own. So I went on this place all on my own. And, in Canada, you've got to tell people the route you're taking and so forth. And so I talked to the rangers and said, well, this is the route I want to take. And he said, what's a great route to pass? And I said, okay, tell me the safe way to get through. Because I don't have anybody with me. And he kind of gave me the safe way to get through. Anyway, I got up to that glacier to pass. And I said, this is a piece of cake. No problem. It's just a big snowfield here. And I didn't bother to put on my crampons. And so I got up to the top of the pass, and there was deep snow everywhere, and everything was fine. I had my ice axe, so I figured, hey, if anything goes wrong, I got my ice axe. Anyway, suddenly the rain came down. And when the rain came down, it washed away some snow ahead of me, and it was bare ice. And I wasn't aware of the bare ice until it was too late. I was going to put my crampons on. But I hit that bare ice and slipped. And then went down the slope. And we're talking a couple of thousand feet I was going down. And I could see the crevasses ahead of me. And I was heading right for them. But I managed to get my ice axe. It took quite a while because I wasn't ready for this. Eventually got my ice axe underneath me, rolled over, and finally came to a stop. When I looked behind me, my feet were just 6 inches from the lip of the crevasse. So, I mean, it was a nice deep crevasse. So I managed to get up and walk my way out. But I look at those as two examples. And by the way, what happened as I was going towards the crevasse is I hit a couple of rocks. And those rocks slowed me down enough, and I was able to get my ice axe position that I could actually put myself into an arrest and stop. Now, those rocks beat me up pretty badly, but they stopped me. And if there were no rocks, I would have gone right into that crevasse. And being all on my own, I would have been in deep trouble. So those are just two examples in my life where I look back on it and say, you know, God was looking out for me. I walked out. Yeah, because now I was at the bottom and I could kind of see a nice level way. I wanted to save myself an hour and a half. That's another way to say, well, God's safe, because, you know, by the time I got out of there, it was already dark. And I said, you know, if I had taken that extra hour and a half, that could have been bad news, too. So, God took care of me all the way around. So, but I want to have some examples. My guess is every person in this class here could share a story. So, hopefully I've given you enough time that you can come up with one of your own, because... And by the way, I could give you all kinds of stories. I think it'd be just a good idea if you actually go home today and just say, okay, Lord, jog my memory. Because, you know, if you're more than 30 years old, I can guarantee God has supernaturally rescued you and kept you out of trouble. Maybe not out of debt, but at least kept you out of trouble. Maybe kept you away from a bad girlfriend or a bad boyfriend. You can probably think of examples on that line, too. So anyone want to share? Yeah. So you got a spinning car and suddenly you don't hit. Wasn't spinning. Right. But miraculously you didn't hit anything. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. How many of us have done that? Wow, wow. Y'all heard that one? Falling out of a high tree and his tusk caught a twig and stopped him with his head just that far from the ground, and he was going back and forth like this, thanking God for those cuffs. And I guess back in those days, cuffs were made of a little stronger material than they are today. Yeah, go ahead. Some metal bouncing all over the shed and nobody got hit. Yeah, Jackie. And he didn't die. All right. Go ahead. Good thing you had that big bucket truck up there. Rescue all those people. Very good. Any other miracles on this class? Got to be more than two or three. Okay. By the way, that's very good advice. If you ever get brutally attacked, call upon the Lord for protection. So, because you've got plenty of evidence that He will protect you from events that have taken place in the past. Yeah, Jim. Right, right.
Well, one of my fondest memories of Cliff Stewart over here is when Kathy and I were having some problems with our beat-up old yellow Honda, and it just failed on us. And he said, open up the hood. I said, well, no, I guess this guy knows something about auto mechanics. And he opened up the hood, and what he did is he prayed over the engine. Turned the ignition on, worked fine. And I'm going to close with that, because what we've been talking about is how God intervenes in each of our lives on an individual basis and performs miracles in our behalf. I find it quite phenomenal. He's even willing to do that for my automobile, not just for me personally. And he does it for our pets and all kinds of other things. And this is Job's point, that God has given us overwhelming evidence that he has kind thoughts for us. He provides for us. He watches over us. And when we get into Elihu's gospel, he really drives this point home in a way that's very specific. So we're going to have to close here. Next week, we'll get into what Job has got to say about God's justice and how he falls short of God's standard. He knows that, and how there must be a Redeemer, and how he makes that step of trying to figure up on the record of nature how he can come into a relationship with his Redeemer and even get the guarantee of his salvation. And then we have Elihu coming in and actually not restating it, but stating the gospel in a way completely different from Job, but making the same point. So come back next week, and we'll start off with this. I'm not going to give you a review. We'll just jump into this next week. Let's bow. Father in heaven, we thank you for these great men of God that have written down these insights and his wisdom so many thousands of years ago, and how relevant it is to each one of us today. And Lord, it's remarkable, Lord, how they were able to discern from your record of nature the things that they did. Help us to pay attention. Father, it's sometimes difficult living in an urban environment, not seeing the things that our forefathers saw so easily. So open up our eyes that we can see through. And Lord, I pray you would jog our memories so we would recognize that many times you've supernaturally intervened in our lives to keep us alive, and to keep us focused on the purpose for which you have us here on planet Earth. And Lord, may we appreciate just the depth of your kindness and your love and your tenderness to each one of us, in the past, now, and in the future. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, thank you.